Captain Corelli's Mandolin by Louis de Bernier. Dramatized by Katie Hymns. A pea in the ear.
Dr. Yanis found himself gazing down into an ear that was more dank and stalagmatic than any Drogherati cave. He was aware that his patient stomatis had been deaf in one ear since childhood, and that this had been a constant source of pain. Dr. Yanis tilted the old man's head and peered into the ear. There he beheld a pea. It was undoubtedly a pea. It was light green, and its surface was slightly wrinkled.
Stomatis, have you ever stuck anything down your ear?
Only my finger.
And how long have you been deaf?
As long as I can remember.
A bizarre picture rose up in the doctor's mind. Stomatis as a toddler, with the same gnarled old face he had now, reaching up to the kitchen table and taking a dried pea from a wooden bowl.
Do you have a fishing hook, about the right size for a mullet, with a long shank? And do you have a light hammer?
What does that have to do with my ear?
You have an auditory impediment. I can remove it with a fishhook and a hammer.
Then the doctor paused to reflect that if the pea was very hard, there was a good chance that he would drive the pea even deeper into the ear and possibly even break the drum.
Upon further thought, it would be better to fill your ear up with water and mollify the supererogatory occlusion.
Dr. Yanis left a grumbling stomatis lying on his side with an ear full of water and strict instructions not to move until he returned. Several hours later, the doctor was able to hook the softened pea straight out of the ear without any need for a hammer. Stomatis clapped his hand to the side of his head.
It's cold in here. My God, and it's loud. It's a miracle, that's what it is.
The doctor found himself walking home with a fat pullet under each arm, a shiny dark aubergine stuffed into each pocket, and an ancient pea wrapped up in his handkerchief. It had been a good day, and he was left with a whole evening ahead of him to write his history of Kefalonia, as long as Pelagia had remembered to purchase some more oil for lamps.
Kefalonia is a factory that breeds babies for export. There are more Kefalonians abroad or at sea than there are at home. Our men go abroad and return here to die. And so we are an island of children, spinsters, priests, and the very old. The single good thing about it is that only the beautiful women find husbands among those men that are left. And so the pressure of natural selection has ensured that we have the most beautiful women in all of Greece. The unhappy thing about this is that we have beautiful and spirited women married to the most grotesque and inappropriate husbands. And we have some sad and ugly women that nobody wants.
Writing the new history of Kefalonia was proving to be a problem. It seemed impossible to write it without the intrusion of his own feelings and prejudices.
This island betrays its own people merely by existing.
This would never do. Why could he not write like a writer of histories? Why could he not write without passion and anger?
A personal history of Kefalonia.
Now he could say whatever he liked.
The half-forgotten island of Kefalonia rises improvidently and advisedly from the Ionian Sea.
The doctor got up and went out into the yard to relieve himself into a patch of mint. He returned just in time to catch Pelagia's little goat eating his writings with evident satisfaction.
Pelagia! Your accursed goat has eaten everything I've written tonight. How many times do I have to tell you not to let it indoors? Any more incidents like this, and it'll end up on the spit.
Baba will be eating at about 10 o'clock.
Did you hear what I said? No more goats in the house.
You're as fond of him as I am.
No, I am not. And you will not argue with me. In my day, no daughter argued with her father.
Baba, it still is your day. You aren't dead yet, are you?
In the town square, Megalo Velisarios, dressed as a pantomime Turk in pantaloons and curlicued slippers, self-proclaimed as the strongest man who had ever lived, was hopping on one leg in time to the clapping hands. His arms outstretched, he bore seated upon each stupendous bicep a full-grown man. On Belisarius' head, for good measure, sat an anxious little girl who was complicating his manoeuvres.
Lemoni, take your hands from my eyes and hold on to my hair or I'll have to stop.
With one graceful movement like that of a swan when it comes to land, he tossed both men to their feet and then he lifted Lemoni from his head and flung her high into the air, caught her under her arms, kissed her on the tip of her nose and set her down.
Sweet, please.
Here you go. I will lift anything that it takes three men to lift.
Lift the trough!
It's too long. I won't be able to get a grip on it.
Father Arsenios chose just this moment to emerge from his little house and waddle portentously towards the crowd on his way to church.
Lift Father Arsenios!
It's impossible!
Father Arsenios found himself grasped beneath the armpits and lifted bodily up onto the wall. He sat there blinking, too astonished to protest, his mouth working like a fish. Suddenly, there was an embarrassed silence, and Velisarios began to wish that he could crawl away and hide. It was a terrible crime to humiliate God's mouthpiece in public, however contemptible he might be as a man and a priest. Pelagia stepped forward and extended a hand to help him down.
Father Arsenios, let me help you.
Father Arsenios, please.
Belisarios offered another, but neither of them were able to prevent him from landing heavily and sprawling in the dust.
Let me begin by saying that I, Carlo Piero Guercio, upon joining the Julia division of the Italian army, fell in love with a young married corporal who accepted me as his best friend, without ever suspecting what I felt. Although I had a mother, a father, brothers and sisters, it was in the army that I found my true family. We were all young together, and we never again felt so invincible and immortal. What spoiled it was that none of us had an easy conscience about this rebuilding of the Roman Empire. At first, there was no fighting to speak of, and we were blissfully oblivious to the notion that the Duce might order us to invade Greece.
You shouldn't have done that, Belisarius. It was cruel and horrible. Think how he must be feeling. You must go to the church and apologize.
The act is over, everyone.
But we want to see the cannon.
Yes, we want to see the cannon.
All right, the cannon.
What about apologizing to the priest?
I'll go later, Pelagia.
Good people of the village, to see the cannon, all you must do is give me your old rusty nails, your broken bolts, your shards of pots, and the stones of your streets. Find me these things whilst I pack the gun with powder.
Velisarios poured a generous amount of powder down into the magazine, tamped it ceremoniously in the full consciousness of the need for drama, and then allowed the little boys to scoop handfuls of the accumulated ammunition into the barrel.
So, who do you want me to shoot?
The Prime Minister!
Success!
A useless donkey! A donkey? What do you think I am?
With theatrical aplomb, the enormous man lit the fuse of the gun where it stood propped against the wall, picked it up as though it were as light as a carbine, and braced himself with one foot forward and the cannon cradled above the hip.
Oh, Cristemo!
What are you doing?
I didn't see you.
Oh, you crazy lugger. Oh,
my apologies, sir.
Are you all right?
Do I look all right?
Belisarios, we need to get this man to my father.
Yes,
Mandras was later to thank Velisarius for shooting him with a Turkish cannon as he came round the bend at the entrance of the village. He had not enjoyed having a bent nail extracted from his shoulder, nor had it been very economic to cease fishing for 2 weeks while the wound healed. On this day, he first laid eyes on Pelagia.
His name was Francesco. He came from Genoa and was an entirely beautiful boy. His skin was darker than mine, like that of a southerner, but he was slender and smooth-skinned. Everybody loved him. He never got promotion, and nor did he care. He adopted a wild mouse called Mario, who lived in his pocket. It seems clear, in retrospect, that an invasion of Greece must have been the ultimate intention. There were clues everywhere, if only we had seen them. And I commit here an account involving Francesco and myself, which demonstrates clearly that it was our side who started the war with the Greeks.
In the church, Father Arsenios hid behind the screen that protected the icons and dropped his face into his hands. It was the worst thing in the world to be a complete failure who had no prospect of any other job. He peeked round the corner of the screen to see that someone had left him a loaf of bread. He found himself smacking his lips and wishing for some cheese to accompany it. There were more footsteps, and he quickly hid himself away. When the feet departed, he saw that someone had left him a large, soft, succulent cheese.
A miracle. Thanks be to God.
Gradually, the entrance of the church filled up with gifts that the villagers left as a token of apology. Fish, vegetables, handkerchiefs, slippers, and several dozen bottles of Robola. As the pile grew, he became urgently aware of the need to urinate. He prayed to St. Gerasimos for relief. On conclusion of the prayer, he was visited by inspiration. Out in the church was a large supply of bottles. He listened intently for footsteps. Then he nipped out, grabbed a bottle of Robola, and hurried back behind the screen. But what could he do with the wine? Seemed ashamed to waste it. Father Arsenios peeped through the hole to ensure that he would not be heard and released a stream of urine into the bottle. The bottle filled at an alarming rate, and he had to rub the splashback into the dusty church floor. A quarter of an hour passed, and Father Arsenios emptied another bottle and refilled it with urine. Another quarter of an hour, and he had to repeat the whole procedure again. This time his aim, his balance, and his judgment were completely off. At this same moment, Velisarios came in, and the priest gave himself away.
Padre.
Go away.
I have come to apologize.
I'm trying to pray.
But, Padre, I want to kiss your hand.
I can't come out.
What do you mean?
I don't feel well.
Do you want me to fetch Dr. Yanis?
No.
Well, I apologize, Padir, for what I did. And to make amends, I've left you a bottle of wine. Padir? Padir?
Velisarios stepped behind the screen and beheld the priest lying in a pool of urine and vomit.
Padir! Padir.
And so it was that Velisarios' penance for submitting the priest to the indignity of the morning was that he should be obliged to carry the colossal weight of him to the doctor's house. Inside the house, the doctor was forcing the priest to drink jar upon jar of water.
I think I'm dying.
Oh, believe me, Patia, you are not.
Later, when everyone had left, the doctor complained to Pelagia.
Surely a priest should set a better example than this. I don't remember any priest as bad as this, and we've had some bad ones, God knows. Pelagia?
Yes, Babaka.
Did you hear anything I just said?
No, Babaka.
What's the matter with you?
But Pelagia was thinking about Mandras.
Colonel Rivolta was short, fat, bored, and the owner of several medals from the Abyssinian campaign that he did absolutely nothing to win. He greeted us with the Roman salute. At 0200 hours tomorrow night, you two will go under cover of darkness to this point here, and he showed us a spot on the map, and Francesco said, "But this is Greek territory." Rivolta said, I know, I am not stupid. There are no Greeks there, so they will not know. Now, there is a watchtower there, a wooden one, and it has been taken over by a band of brigands who have killed the guards and adopted their uniforms. They look like our soldiers, but they are not. It will be your task to take this tower. Later, Francesco said the whole thing seemed very fishy. When we got our supplies from the quartermaster, it looked even worse. Our special supplies consisted of British military uniforms and a Hotchkiss light machine gun that was popular with the Greeks.
Dr. Yanis! Dr. Yanis!
Slow down, Koritsimu. Good morning.
Please, I found a funny kind of cat.
Lemoni took the doctor to a patch of briar and scrub, fell to her knees and began to crawl on all fours through a tunnel that looked as if it had been forged by wild animals.
There it is. It's the funny cat and it's still tired.
It's not tired, Koritsimu. And it's not a cat.
What is it then?
It is a pine marten. And look, it's got caught on the wire. I think it would be best to kill it because it's going to die anyway.
You can't kill it. You've got to save it.
It's got a barb through its stomach.
But you can make it better. I brought you here to help it.
All right. Let's see what we can do.
Careful.
Being as careful as I can.
The doctor winced at the thought of the lethal bite that might leave him foaming at the mouth or lying in bed with his jaw locked. He decided he must be mad or stupid or both. He put the kitten in the pocket of his coat and then took Lemoni home. He then proceeded to his own house, only to find that Mandras was in the yard, engaging Pelagia in animated conversation as she attempted to sweep up.
Here again, Mandra.
Oh, Kalimera, Yadre. I've been having some trouble with my shoulder.
What kind of trouble?
The wound is itching.
Itching?
That's right.
Mandra, you know perfectly well that wounds always itch when they're in the process of healing. You also know perfectly well that I know perfectly well that you have only come here to flirt with Pelagia.
Papa?
Yadre, you misjudge me.
Yesterday you brought us another fish and then flirted with Pelagia for 1 hour and 10 minutes. Well, you better get on with it because I'm not wasting time on a perfectly healthy wound. I haven't had breakfast, and I've got a funny kind of a cat in my pocket.
Dr. Yanis placed the expiring animal carefully on the table and contemplated it.
Such a very small and fragile skull would be easy to crush. There'd be no suffering involved. But I can't give you back to Lemoni with your skull crushed, can I? Perhaps I should break your neck.
In the kitchen, the doctor went to fetch a bottle of alcohol, and then he bathed the wound carefully and put a single easy stitch in it.
Easy. There we go.
Yeah. Pelagia entered the kitchen, wondering whether her father had seen her kissing Mandras, and fully expecting some kind of explosion. So she was amazed when her father did not look up.
Pelagia, did we get any mice in the traps today?
We got two, Babaka.
Well, go and dig them out of wherever you threw them. And grind them up.
Grind them up?
Yes. Yeah. Mince them. Oh, and bring me some straw. Go on. Off you go.
Pelagia, did he see us?
I don't think so.
What did he say?
He wants me to mince some mice and find him some straw.
He's a funny fellow.
You can go and find the straw if you like.
Well, thanks. I just love looking for straw.
There might be a recompense.
For a kiss, I would lick a pigsty.
If you licked a pigsty, do you honestly think I would kiss you?
The next day, Lemony called to see the doctor and was delighted to hear that the funny kind of cat would make a complete recovery.
So, you need to decide on a name.
Psipsina. We should call it Psipsina.
Well, you can't call it that. It isn't a cat.
Well, I'm not a lemon, and I'm called Lemony.
The order was to attack at 2 o'clock, but we had been freezing for hours and we could not see the point in any further delay. We decided to scout the watchtower. There were 10 men where we had expected only 3. There were 4 machine guns perched on the outer railings. Francesco was furious that 2 of us had been sent against 10 men. I wondered how brigands would get their hands on 4 brand new machine guns. Under the tower, we discovered a large heap of kindling and a drum of kerosene. The tower went up like a torch. Then we fired and fired until we had used a complete belt of ammunition. If there were screams, we could not hear them. We were only aware of the leaping gun, the clenching of our own teeth, and the horribleness of desperate action. Afterwards, Francesco found the body of Captain Ruata of the Bersaglieri. It was Francesco, too, who found the orders that instructed the captain to take 9 men to the tower in anticipation of an attack by the Greek army, which intelligence expected at 0200 hours. It was Francesco who said, "The Greeks wear the same uniform as the British, don't they? These uniforms, Carlo. We are the Greeks and we are supposed to be dead." This was when we knew for certain that the Italian authorities wanted a war with Greece. We received medals for what we had done and were ordered not to wear them. We had been tricked into becoming accomplices to murder.
The war had yet to have any impact on the island of Cephalonia. Today was the feast of St. Gerasimos. On this day, the mad people from the asylum all hoped that a miracle would cure them, because every year, without fail, St. Gerasimos would cure at least 1 person from insanity. And afterwards, everyone on the island would get lime drunk. Mandras had started drinking early, and as soon as he saw Pelagia, he fell to his knees.
Pelagia, will you marry me? Marry me or I'll die!
Of course I'll marry you.
Yes! She said yes! Carissimo, I love you with all my heart, but we can't get married until I come back from the army.
Mandramo, you should go and speak to my father.
I'll go now.
Pelagia wandered amongst the revelers, trying to digest this contradictory miracle. She felt troubled by the curious way in which she did not feel as happy as she ought. Meanwhile, Mandras failed to find the doctor before drink overcame him completely. Mandras put in no appearance for 2 days after the Feast of the Saint, leaving Pelagia to ferment in an agony of agitation.
I expect he hasn't come because he's feeling as sick as everyone else.
Do you think that is really it?
Well, what else would it be?
Baba Kai has asked me to marry him, and I told him he'd have to ask you.
I don't want to marry him. It'd be much better if he married you, I think.
Very funny.
We used to have some Arabs on one of my ships. They always said, "Inshallah," after every sentence. "I'll do it tomorrow, Inshallah." Could be very annoying. Because they seem to expect God to do things when they couldn't be bothered themselves. But there is some wisdom in it. You will marry Mandras if that is what Providence decrees.
Don't you approve of him, Babaka?
He's too young, Pelagia. Everyone is too young when they marry. I was. Also, I have not done you a favour. You read the poetry of Cavafi. I have taught you to speak Italian. He isn't your equal, and he would expect to be better than his wife. He is a man, after all.
The doctor stood up and went inside. When he re-emerged, Pelagia was horrified to see that he held a gun.
There is going to be a war, and terrible things happen in wars. I want you to use this to defend yourself. Koritsimu, it might happen that your marriage will have to wait.
On the third day after the feast, Pelagia went down to the sea. She sat on a rock and thought about war and felt her heart grow heavy. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a body diving about in the waves like a human dolphin. He must have been 100 meters away, and she knew that he was arranging a buoyed net with a mesh tiny enough to catch whitebait. She watched the brown fisherman with a pleasure that was entirely aesthetic, until she realized with a small shock that he was naked. Pelagia crept closer. She watched as the net was curled about the shoal and as he stood glistening on the beach like a beautiful male sea nymph. Finally, she recognized that this was Mandras. She felt a sudden wave of shame, but still she did not creep away. He placed two fingers in his mouth and whistled. She saw that he was looking out to sea, waving his arms in a slow semaphore above his head. Then she glimpsed three dark shapes curving in unison towards him. She watched him wade to meet them with three large fish in his hands. She saw him throw the fish high into the air and the three dolphins leap and twist to catch them. She saw him grasp a dorsal fin and sweep out to sea. Only as he disappeared out of sight did she remember that it was terribly bad luck to see a nymph naked. It brought about delirium and occasionally death.
Pelagia! Pelagia!
Hello, Mandra.
I'm sorry I didn't come sooner.
I wondered where you were.
It's just that I was so ill the day after the feast. It was the wine. And yesterday I had to go into Argostoli to get my call-up papers.
Oh.
And I've got to go to the mainland tomorrow.
Tomorrow? That's so soon.
But I've spoken to your father at the Gafenion, and he's given his consent.
Mandra!
And I've brought you some fish. Look, some whitebait.
We were told that the Greeks were demoralized and corrupt, and that they would desert to fight on our side. We were told that the war would be over in seconds. We were sent off to die with no transport, no equipment, no tanks worthy of the name, an air force that was mainly in Belgium, insufficient troops, and no officers above the rank of colonel. Our lines of communication and supply became inoperable before a shot had even been fired. My rifle began to rust. I was supplied with the wrong ammunition. We heard that we would get no air defense, but still, we were convinced that we would have an easy victory. We thought the Greeks were not opposing us because their forces were weak and cowardly, and it elated us in spite of everything. It did not occur to us that they had gone into an elastic defense in order to concentrate their force. We battled through the rain and the mud, whilst above us the Greeks waited patiently on the titanic Mount Smolikas.
Dearest Mandras, did you get the socks that I made for you, and the fisherman's sweater, and the scarf? I hope you got the coffee, and the jar of honey, and the smoked meat. I shudder to think how cold it must be in the mountains of Epirus, how you must miss your boat, and your dolphins. Did you realize that I knew about your dolphins? Everything here is much the same, except that we are beginning to go short of things. Yesterday, I couldn't get oil for the lamps, and last week there was no flour to make bread.
We reached the river Sarandoporos and found that all the bridges had been blown up and that we had no bridge-building equipment and no engineers. Francesco saved my life by coming after me when I was swept away during an attempt to get a gun across. It was the first time he had held me in his arms.
Dear Mandras,
I have heard nothing from you for such a long time. You have not written since that sad day I saw you off in Sami. I have written to you every day, and I am beginning to suppose that you never got my letters, or that your replies do not reach me on account of the war, and I have nightmares that you were dead. Please, please write back to me so that I can breathe again.
November the 1st, 1940. A sniper shot our corporal. Almost immediately afterwards, mortar bombs fell amongst us. We realized that there was no way to get the wounded back behind the lines. Francesco put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Carlo, shoot me if I'm wounded." The Greeks had maneuvered us into positions where we could be surrounded and cut off, and yet we very rarely saw them. We ate nothing but dry biscuits. Our horses began to die, and we began to eat them.
Everybody here has been moved by the spirit of the war. My father offered to go to the front, but they turned him down when they found that he had learned everything on ships and has no qualifications.
We grew immense beards. We were buried in storms of sleet. Our bloodshot eyes sank deep into our heads. Our hands were torn as though by cats. Francesco looked the same as me, and I, Carlo Guercio, looked the same as everyone else, only bigger.
Mandras, I've begun to crochet a big cover for our marriage bed, but then I had to unpick quite a lot because it went wrong and began to look like a dead animal.
We saw an Italian bomber at long last. We waved to it, and it dropped a bomb that narrowly missed us, but killed three of our mules. We ate the mules raw. At night, Francesco and I slept huddled together for warmth. I was too exhausted for lust. I only wanted to protect him. The civilian population hunted us with sporting rifles and slings. An entire week passed without food or respite. Francesco talked to his mouse, even during the ambushes, and all of us were on the verge of madness.
Mandras, I have seen your mother, and she tells me she has no news of you either. She's so worried. Her face is more lined than it was before. Please write to her, even if you do not write to me. Your dolphins wait for you, and your boat, and your island, and I wait for you too. I who love you so much and miss you as if you were a limb of my body that has been cut off. Your loving fiancée, Pelagia.
Francesco became a stranger who could not remember that my name was Carlo. He was convinced that he would be shot through the heart, and had therefore moved the mouse Mario from his breast pocket to a pocket on the sleeve of his shirt. We had to retreat, but there was nowhere to retreat to. We had no bandages or field hospitals. A chaplain extracted shrapnel from my arm without anaesthetic on the kitchen table of a roofless cottage. I was too cold to feel the knife in my flesh. I thanked God that I had been wounded and not Francesco.
I got halfway through the bed cover, but then Sipsina was sick on it and I had to wash it. It didn't shrink, thanks be to God, but when I laid it out to dry, the goat ate three mouthfuls from the middle. I am beginning to think that fate wants me to make something else.
The threads of my uniform rotted and fell apart. The cloth hardened like cardboard. It garnered the cold like a refrigerator. I shot a goat and clothed myself in its skin. Koritsa was abandoned to the enemy, and we now had less territory than we had possessed when we started. The snow fell relentlessly, and we discovered that we could warm our heads by cutting out the brains of dying mules and putting them in our helmets. My boots fell apart and I itched and squirmed with lice. Waking up in the morning, 10 degrees below zero, the first question, who has frozen to death. Francesco has stopped talking to me altogether. He talks only to his mouse.
Mandras, you really must write to your mother. She is so anxious. I'm not criticizing. I just think perhaps you need reminding.
I, Carlo Piero Guercio, am almost ready to surrender. These are the days of the White Death. We do not hate the Greeks, but we do hate the White Death. Above the boots the legs swell, and below the boots the foot falls asleep. The legs turn lurid colours, shades of lilac, ebony and black. Because I am a very big man, I spend days carrying our afflicted boys back behind the lines. We have been reduced to 1,000 men with 15 machine guns and 5 mortars. We have lost 4,000 men. Francesco is undoubtedly mad. His mouth works continually, his eyes roll in his head, and he does not recognize me. All my love turns to pity.
Mandras, this is my 100th letter to you, and still we have heard nothing. Babaca says that no news is good news, and so I don't know whether to feel sad or reassured. I thank God that your name has never appeared in the list of the dead that is posted in Argustoli.
As day succeeded day, it became clear that Mandras would never actually write back. The doctor diagnosed the evident symptoms of depression in his daughter and broke the habit of a lifetime. He made Pelagia accompany him on his medical visits. He also sent her on improbable errands to places that were unfeasibly distant in order to ensure that she was tired enough to sleep properly at night. He perceived that Pelagia considered it both logical and dutiful that she should be sad, passive, and remote. So he made a point not only of making her laugh, but also provoking her to fits of rage, often by small acts of sabotage.
Babaca?
Yes?
Where is the olive oil?
The olive oil?
What have you done with it?
I haven't done anything with it.
Well, it's not where it always is, so you must have. What am I supposed to cook with today? Oh. And where are my spoons?
Oh, I don't know anything about spoons.
You've moved all my spoons from the drawer.
Now, why would I do that?
I don't know. Maybe because you're crazy.
Curiously, the doctor felt a sense of shock when his treatment began to work. Her normal, cheerful equanimity seemed to be restored, and he wondered if she had given up her passion for Mandras altogether. On the one hand, he would have been glad of this, since he did not truly believe that Mandras would make a good husband. Then the awful possibility occurred to him that Pelagia might finish up marrying a man she no longer loved, purely out of a sense of obligation. The doctor found himself guiltily hoping that Mandras would not survive the war, and this led him to the uncomfortable suspicion that he was not as good a man as he always deluded himself into believing.
Francesco's mother was a small, grey woman with a mole on one cheek. She wore black, and all the time I talked to her, she twisted a duster in her hands.
When did he die, Signor? Was it a good day?
He died on a fine day, Signora, with the sun shining and the birds singing. In truth, he died on a day when the snow was melting, on a day when 1,000 broken corpses, knapsacks, rusted rifles, water bottles, illegible unfinished letters drenched in blood, suddenly emerged from the cover of winter.
Did he die happy, Signor?
He died with a smile on his lips, and he told me that he was proud to have done his duty. You should be pleased to have had such a son, Signora. In truth, Francesco limped up to me in the trench with a wild expression in his eyes. He spoke to me for the first time in weeks. He rolled up his trousers and I saw the purple ulcers of white death. He clasped me in his arms and kissed me on both cheeks. He took his mouse, Mario, from his pocket and gave it to me. Then he took his rifle and clambered over the trench. He advanced slowly on the enemy position, stopping to fire at every 5 paces. The Greeks perceived his heroism and did not return fire. They preferred to capture courageous men than shoot them. A mortar shell fell next to him, and he disappeared beneath a shower of yellow clay.
He died quickly, didn't he, Signor? He was not in any pain.
He died very quickly, of a bullet through the heart. He can have felt nothing. In truth, when I reached Francesco, I saw that the side of his head had been blown away. He was still alive. I picked him up and stood to face the Greeks. There was a silence, and then a cheer came from their lines, and one of them shouted out, "Bravissimo!" I carried Francesco back to my lines. He was so emaciated from the winter, he was as light as a sparrow. It took him 2 hours to die. I told him that I had always loved him, and he told me that he knew. He asked me for Mario, and I placed the mouse in his hand. He did not ask me to shoot him. Perhaps, at the very end, he loved his vanishing life. In the moment of his death, he clenched his fist so tightly that the mouse died with him. When Francesco was dead, I held his broken head and kissed him on the lips.
Signor, where is he buried?
He's buried on the side of a mountain that in spring is covered in tulips and receives the first light of the sun. He was buried with full military honours, and shots were fired over his grave by his comrades. In truth, I buried him myself. I dug a deep hole that instantly filled with water. I loaded him with stones so that his corpse would not rise to the surface.
Signor, as long as he did not die for nothing.
Signora, we now have mastery over Greece with the help of our German allies. We lost the war and were saved only when the Germans invaded Bulgaria and opened a second front that the Greeks had no resources to defend. The valiant Greeks fell before 1,100 German panzers, which they faced with less than 200 light tanks. Our glorious Italian advance consisted merely in following them as they retreated in a vain attempt to avoid the German encirclement. I took no part in that charade, because the day after I buried Francesco, I took a pistol and shot myself through the thigh.
Captain Corelli's Mandolin by Louis de Bernier, dramatized by Katie Himes. Pelagia was played by Celia Mayras. Dr. Yanis by Stephen Greif. Carlo by Anthony Pesela. Mandras by Chris Pavlo. And the narrator was Tom Goodman Hill. Velisarios was played by Alexi K. Campbell. Father Arsenios by Alex Zorbas. Limoni by Anya Gordon. Francesco's mother by Liza Sadovi, and Stamatis by Sean Baker. Original mandolin music was composed and played by Alison Stevens. The director was David Hunter.